Coming up, C.L. Breeze takes us to the seedy underbelly of rural America. Plus, we have not one, not two, but three guests who make book recommendations. I'm Brad Shreve, and you're listening to Queer Writers of Crime, featuring LGBTQ authors of mystery, suspense, and thriller novels. We're sponsored by Requeered Tales, preserving our LGBTQ literary heritage one book at a time. Check them out at requeeredtales.com. Well, listeners, I have sad news this week. Justine, once again, is not with us. And I don't have Gregory Ash to fill in for her either. But actually, I have something better. We brainstormed a little bit, and it's mostly Justine's idea. She said, why don't you get some of our regular listeners on and do book recommendations for me? And I'm like, that's awesome. So I reached out to a bunch of them, the ones that we know through donations or emails, or a lot of folks keep in touch with us regularly. And some were like, I love your show. I don't want to be on it. But I had three very brave individuals, Sean, Philip, and Rich, who said, we will be more than happy to do a book recommendation on the show. So I'm very grateful that you folks are on. And I'm going to do a quick introduction to each of you. I want you guys to let me know when you started listening to the show and how did you find Queer Writers of Crime. The first one of the guests is named Sean. And I want to thank you very much, Sean, for participating. Sean sounded perfect when we recorded this session. Unfortunately, when it came time to edit, the audio it was very difficult to understand. And I worked on it all week, and I just couldn't get it where you would be able to hear it on a podcast. But I do want to speak on Sean's behalf. I'm not speaking on his behalf. I'm going to tell you the things he said. He started listening to our show around the fourth or fifth episode. He isn't exactly sure how he found the show, but he believes he was Googling gay mysteries, and in searching through Google, he happened to stumble on the show, which, if that's the case, that's wonderful. I'm excited. That's the way I like people to find the show, by accident like that. Philip, how about you?
Well, first I want to say thank you, Brad, so much for having us on the show. I'm a huge fan. I also am not sure I really remember, but I know it was very, very early on. This Queer Writers of Crime is my number one favorite podcast. I've listened to all the episodes, and I really feel like the recommendations and interviews have added so much to my reading pleasure. I'm a public librarian by trade, so books and reading are really part of my livelihood, so it's just been a great journey with you and Justin.
Well, we love librarians, so welcome. How about you, Rich?
So I started when the pandemic started last March or so, because I used to do a lot of these other activities. I'm retired, and I used to do a lot of activities, and I started walking every day around the complex because I couldn't go anywhere else. And I started searching for podcasts, and I found you. And so I only started then, but since I was walking every day, I actually did listen backwards to episode one. So I did listen to you, and I didn't think they were that bad. I know you always say that, but I didn't think they were that bad. You were a little rougher, but you definitely got into a rhythm quickly. And I have to say, I agree with Philip. I actually just finished a book that she reviewed 2 weeks ago, that the one that was the young adult tie and whatever. And it's great. I love Justine's reviews, and I love listening to the authors. And then you gave me the courage to actually contact authors, which I've done on Facebook, just to say I like their books, and they do appreciate it. So I thank you for that.
Yeah, a lot of people, I think actually you were one of them. Like, you were really surprised that an author responded back when you reached out to me. And I'm like, we love to hear from readers. It's kind of a isolating job. We kind of get a little lonely sometimes and don't people are buying our books. We can see the numbers, but are they really out there? So it's great when we have people to reach out. I reached out to a lot of authors before I started writing and never got a negative response. Even from Sue Grafton. She didn't respond herself, but her son-in-law did, and he was very nice. So I didn't expect her to have time to write me a letter, but Anyway, so I'm glad you all are here. I'm glad you found the show. It's very exciting. I will tell people, Justine will definitely be back next week because next week is a really big deal. Next week is episode number 100.
Wow.
So why it took 99 episodes for us to come up with this idea to have listeners do book recommendations, I don't know, but we finally did. And I'm not going to tell you who our guest is on episode number 100, but if you look at our very first episode, you'll have a really good hint.
Okay.
Yeah. He was invited back for the special event. So let's get with the recommendations. Philip, what book are you going to talk about?
Well, Brad, I am going to talk about the Pink's Video Mystery Series from Marshall Thornton. So Marshall is well known for his Boys Town Mysteries with Nick Nowak. There's 13 in that series. And if you look him up on Goodreads, he's got 47 distinct works there. So he's obviously extremely prolific. So a couple years ago, I discovered the Pink's Video Mystery Series and fell in love with it. So it takes place in Silver Lake neighborhood of Los Angeles. It starts out in 1992. The protagonist is Noah Valentine. Noah is HIV positive. He's a video store owner. He's a widower. And after reading the first book, my review on Goodreads was the protagonist, Noah, shows gumption, humor, and hope, which made reading Pink's a breeze. And so I just was really hooked from the get-go. And I've read all five books. And I wanted to really showcase Cash Out, which is book number 5. That's the most current book that Marshall has out. So Cash Out is takes place approximately a year later. It's now Easter of 1993. Noah and his friends, who have sort of formed this Scooby gang, they're all amateur sleuths. They're really funny and really sarcastic together. So they all head to Las Vegas. So the scene goes from Los Angeles, where a lot of the murders and the plots have taken place, to now it's going to Las Vegas. And the reason why it's going to Las Vegas and the reason why I love this book so much is because Noah's mom, Angie, is getting remarried. And I can't remember which book Angie was introduced in, but I fell in love with Angie. I just felt like she was such a great secondary character. So I was thrilled to find out that the whole story basically would revolve around a big event in her life. So to me, Noah and all of his buddies in Los Angeles, the men and women that he's friends with, you know, they're all of a certain age, 30s, 40s, and they're all sort of edgy and everything. And Angie just provides this love and humor and sweetness that I think really balances the books and the series really well. So the gang goes to Las Vegas. Angie's fiance's name is Cotton Preston. He's got 3 grown daughters. So they're in the mix quite a bit as well. And everybody ends up staying at this casino called Lucky Days Casino. And within a very short period of time, I'm not really giving anything away because this is very early on, there's all of this speculation that perhaps Cotton is a mob lawyer. And so that's sort of when the sleuthing begins. It's when the insanity begins. There's a big suitcase of cash. It appears, it disappears, and the sleuthing just starts. So I just love the book so much. I do have to say kudos to Marshall. He manages to add some really subtle touches within his book that adds some historical fiction to it. And in this case, he added philosophers and healers Louise Hay and Shakti Gawain, who were really popular back in the 90s. And I felt like it made it really historically accurate and also authentic. There were a lot of what I call sweet new age gay boys back in the 90s, and I was one of them. And I followed Louise Hay, and I knew about Shakti and everything. So I thought that was added like a lot of depth to the books. So I do want to give a shout out to Marshall and say that if he absolutely could do one more installment, at least of Pink's, I would love it because the entire 5 books has been major sexual tension between him and this really sexy detective named Javier. I want to see them get together. I want to see Noah get rid of his fear of being HIV negative and being in a relationship. I think Javier could embrace Noah. And because there were so many serodiscordant couples back then who not only survived with their love, but also physically survived. And I think it'd be a great thing to have a positive and a negative guy together in a relationship. And what does that mean? And I think he could really, so that's just my little wish list there for Marshall. But Pink's Video Mystery is my current favorite, feel good, lighthearted, very close to a cozy It's got cozy sort of with an edge. And I do want to just mention one other thing before I finish, and that is that up next in my Kindle is a brand new series by Marshall called Dom Riley Mysteries. And number one is called The Year of the Rat. It's a California bartender and an amateur sleuth, and it takes place in Long Beach, California in 1996. So I'm hoping that there's going to be some crossover between, because it's 1992 in Los Angeles, 1996 Long Beach. So I'm hoping that some of the secondary characters might pop back and forth between the two books. So that's what I've got for you.
Well, I hope Marshall forgives me if I'm wrong about this. I did ask him about the next Pink's Video book, because I love the series as well. And if I'm remembering correctly, he didn't say it's over. He just said he's taking a detour, so it's going to be a while.
Okay.
So working on these other series. So I don't think the series is done.
Good.
Based on what I heard from him. And I want to say I do love that series. Marshall is one of the very first authors I got to know on a personal basis. He's a great guy. What I love about the Pink's Video series is since I've lived in Los Angeles, I've spent a lot of time in Silver Lake and even lived there for a short period of time. He's captured it perfectly. And I know Noah and all his friends personally. Every one of those individuals I know very well. It's just a great series. I agree with you. Though I haven't read Cash Out yet. I'll have to read it.
Oh, yes, definitely.
Thank you. Did you have a rating for it?
You know, I tried to look up the ratings and I couldn't find, like, I saw some of the words, but I couldn't find the definitions. I'm so sorry. I would call it, what would be an adjective that I would call it just fun, feel good, you know, I don't know.
She has a delightful.
Delightful's perfect. Thank you.
Okay. Yeah. Perfect. Okay. Let's go to Rich. Rich, what do you have for us?
So the book I want to talk about is one that I've actually mentioned to Brad and Justine. It's The Postscript Murders by Ellie Griffiths. And I'm kind of talking about this because it was a very popular book in the normal fiction mystery world. But it was never really promoted to the LGBT world, in spite of the fact that there's two gay characters, and one of them is the principal detective. And I think it's a unique story. And that's what I look for, kind of cozy, but a little bit unique, a little bit complex, and that's what this book is. So Brad, let me ask you, have you ever used a murder consultant when you wrote your books?
No.
Okay. So this book, it takes place, it's kind of like an Agatha Christie in some ways, because it does take place at the seacoast resort of Shoreham-by-the-Sea in England, and it takes place actually in a senior housing complex, and the woman who is 90 years old, and she is found dead looking out the front window of her apartment, and the business card that her friend, who is an 80-year-old gay ex-religious broadcaster neighbor, finds her. And the business card, which he didn't know about, says murder consultant. And then they start looking at the bookshelf because the other partner in the crime here in the research is the Ukrainian woman who came to help her every day. So she knows Peggy very well. Edwin knows Peggy very well. And they're like, what does this mean, murder consultant? We never knew what she did. She just seemed like a nice, gentle little old Miss Marple sitting in the window. And they start pulling murder mysteries off her bookshelves. And they realize that there is a P.S. in every one of these books that thanks Peggy. And they finally come to the conclusion that her contribution, because they found some kind of in-process manuscripts, her contribution is she comes up with clever ways to murder people that can actually be done. And because the authors are, you know, the authors who have written a series and now they're stuck and they don't know how to kill somebody uniquely anymore. So they start reading, they start looking through this, and then the Ukrainian nurse says, she didn't just die. And the police, of course, said, no, she had a heart attack. She's 90 years old. She just died. And the nurse was like, no, I saw her every day. She didn't die. She would walk up and down the stairs. She did not take the elevator. She didn't die. So they finally get the attention of the DS, Detective Sergeant, as Justine always says in England, whatever the acronyms are. She is a Sikh Indian immigrant, still living at home. She's in her 30s, and she's a lesbian, and her name is Harbinder Kaur. She was actually in the prior book, but is a very minor character. So you don't have to read the first book because it really doesn't go into it. But in this book, she is the primary detective. She is the lead investigator. And Edwin and Natalka, the Russian, are hounding Harbinder. You know, this was murder, this was murder, this was murder. And of course, to add to the mix of characters here, which is again why I love the book, across the street in the coffee shop where everybody seems to hang out, who runs the coffee shop? Well, he's an ex-monk who formerly had taken a vow of silence, couldn't deal with it, and left the monastery. So now you have these three people. You have the Russian, the 80-year-old ex-radio host, and the Indian detective going out trying to find out. And it's all literary aspects. So they have to go interview authors. The authors don't want to talk about that they used a murder consultant. They're very protective. No one's supposed to know this. You know, that's why it's written in a postscript like this. It's a big secret. They shouldn't be, you know, talking. Anyway, there are several murders in the book besides Peggy's, I'll tell you that. And they eventually end up in Aberdeen at a literary crime festival where all the authors are now in the room. And it's one of those, wow, I would never have gotten that this is the way the plot went, because it gets really complicated and very well written. I like the fact that you had multiple age groups. You had, you know, a 30-year-old, you had an 80-year-old, you had the Benedictine monk and Natalka are younger. It just touched all the bases, and it really was fun. It was just a great story. That's what I liked about it the most. It was just a different story, even though it was cozy. You know, there weren't gruesome murders, but there were several murders in the book. So I would also go with a delightful on the Justine scale with this one, because it definitely falls into that category.
The book Sean recommended, he's a guest that isn't here, unfortunately. He recommends Murder Most Lovely, which he read back at the beginning of the pandemic, and he liked it so much, he picked it up again for this show. And again, it's Murder Most Lovely, A Lacetown Murder, by Hank Edwards and Deanna Wadsworth. Now, Sean wanted to stress that it is definitely crime is prime. It is an adult-oriented book. There is a lot of sex and suggestive scenes, and there's nothing wrong with that, but there is a murder. It's funny that he says it is sexy and suggestive, because he says it reads like a cozy mystery with the pace, it's easy, it's fast, and you don't want to put it down, yet it is adult content. Now, the story is a small town in Michigan called Lacetown, and the main character is Michael Fleshman, and he runs the funeral home, and he also happens to be the coroner because it is a small town. He is a fan of famous mystery writer Russell Withingham, who happens to be in town for a book signing, and so Michael goes to see him. And in the process, he meets Jazz, who is Russell's ex-husband. And now Russell also has a boyfriend named Dylan. Well, Dylan is found washed up at shore with his hands cut off, and that usually is kind of suspicious. There are some side plots going on that Sean said he was like, what does this have to do with anything? One of them concerned a drug mule side plot. And he said, however, in the end, it all came together and it made sense why these different story arcs were going on. The reason why Dylan was killed, he didn't want to give anything away, but he said it was interesting and there's a twist. And amongst all this, there is a romance developing between Michael and Jazz. So again, the name of the book is Murder Most Lovely, and it's by Hank Edwards and Deanna Wadsworth, and it is recommended by one of our big fans, Sean. Two Delightfuls, and I found it. Justine calls it flaming.
Flaming, that's right. I couldn't remember the word.
So Two Delightfuls and a flaming.
Flaming.
Flaming. Sorry, Justine.
Flaming.
Well, wonderful, guys. I really appreciate you being on today and helping us out. And Justine won't feel guilty for not being able to make it. She's been really busy with work lately, so it's been hard for us to catch up other than quick messages back and forth. So sit back and enjoy the interview, and glad you made it to episode 99.
Thank you, Brad. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
It's a great time.
Hi, this is Brad. Not only do I interview authors, I write novels too. Check out my Mitchell Riley mystery series on my website, bradshreve.com. Award-winning author C.L. Breeze was born and raised in rural Indiana, a place where the environment was a bit too restrictive to contain his overactive imagination. He needed a place where he could expand his horizons. In 2011, after relocating to Maryland, he followed his passion for forensics and law enforcement and enrolled at the University of Baltimore. 4 years later, he earned not only a BS in police studies, but also an MS in cyber forensic. Welcome, CL, or I'll call you Chris.
Yes. Well, thank you for having me.
I want to thank you for liking so many of my Instagram posts, because that led me one day, for some reason, I decided to check out your profile, and I read it, and I'm like, why hasn't this guy reached out to me to be on my show? And so I'm glad I reached out a hand to you, and welcome. Through the miracle of social media, I feel like I know you.
Yeah.
And so I'm glad you're here.
Well, thanks for having me, and I'm sorry that I didn't reach out to you. I should have reached out much sooner, but I'm glad that you reached out and we were able to make this happen.
I haven't had that many people that write thrillers, so I'm glad that I have you on.
Expand your horizons.
Yes, exactly. And let people know the your most recent novel came out a few months ago. It's Trail of Deception.
Yes.
And it is the second novel in your D.S. Anderson thriller series. And he has two of them, though I read the first one in the series, No Safe Place. Now, I was looking at some information on you, and I saw where you said you overcame your fear of writing when you realize success isn't the amount of books you sell, but simply that you achieved your goal and shared your words with the world.
Right.
Now, my question is, many of us know that logic, and we tell ourselves that, but we still don't move forward. And I'm sure you told yourself that before. What do you think it was that finally gave you that kick in the ass that made you take that action?
Yeah, it's. I started writing my first novel when I was 18. I'm 41 now. That book, I did not publish until I was 36. It was a lot of going back and just editing and re-editing, and never was good enough for me. And my husband finally sat down one day, and he wanted to read the first novel. And he was like, why are you not publishing this? This is amazing. And so I think, and then he gave it to one of his friends to read and they loved it. So I think hearing validation that, people initially enjoyed it helped me get over my fear a little bit. Even though it was people that I know and it wasn't complete strangers, just having that validation that maybe I am good enough to put these words out into the world and share them with everybody was a good way for me to get over the fear. And once I got over that fear, the next books basically came out a new book every year. I just kind of got on a roll, feeling more confident that the books were something people were interested in reading. So,
well, that validation is nice, but there's nothing. You distribute in paperback as well, don't you?
I do. Ebooks, paperback, and recently hardback as well.
Wasn't it nice to get that first physical book in your hand?
It is, yes.
It's an amazing feeling.
It is. And it's just being able to read it. And my books have gone through some cover changes over the years, but I still have the original first book that I ever put out. Before I knew about Amazon KDP and things like that, I went through actually a private publisher to publish mm-hmm. To print the books. So I still have those original books before I did the KDP. So,
what made you decide to go to independent later?
I want to say I have more control over my creativity. I don't have someone telling me what to do, what I need to put in my book, picking covers for me, telling me everything is my decision, from the marketing to the cover to the words I put in there. I think that just gives me more control over how I want my words to come across to my readers.
Yeah, when I was ready to publish my book, I talked to a lot of different authors. I talked to authors that went through traditional publishing. I talked to independent, and then those that do both. I forget what that's called. And through talking to them, to me, it was an easy decision. I'm going to publish on my own. I think down the road, I probably will go through a traditional publisher, probably because of vanity and get validation. But
right.
Financially, I think we're much better off. So let's get right to the books. I want to talk about D.S. Anderson, your protagonist. Yeah. And I'm not going to give anything away by saying he has some demons he deals with, because that's pretty much in the beginning.
Straight from the get-go.
Oh, yeah. He has some issues. So tell us about him.
Yeah, so D.S. Anderson, he's a troubled soul. He grew up closeted. Grew up in a small town in Saskatchewan, but he always had a passion for law enforcement. And then when he was about four, something happened to his mother. She just one day just disappeared. No one knows what happened to her. Even throughout the book, you still don't know what happens to her. And so I think a lot of the dealing with the alcoholism of his father and a lot of the just, normal demons that most of us deal with, it just turned him into the person he is. He's stubborn. But he's also rogue. He does his own thing. And I think that is what led him into his career of law enforcement.
Now, one thing I'm curious about, he lives in Regina.
Yes.
But this story takes place in a town of Cedar Lake.
Cedar Lake.
And I presume that's fictional?
It is a fictional town, yes.
Okay, good. I'm glad, because you really rag on that town. I think the villagers would come at you with pitchforks and you'd be in serious trouble. So I'm glad you chose a fictional town.
Yeah. Yeah. So he left 10 years before when the book, the beginning of the book, he's going back after being gone from 10 years from this small Cedar Lake. He, left to get away from his demons. He thought leaving, that small town would make his life better, but he still is drawn back to this place because his best friend, Gemma, it is really only true connection to that town still, and she needs his help.
I was curious as I was reading it, because he is a police officer, but you took him to a small town to do this investigation for a friend of his.
Right.
And I wondered, since it really didn't deal with the police department and you didn't have to deal with the forensics and how that works, why you chose a cop instead of a PI or an amateur detective?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think choosing him, he's planned out. There's several more books planned out for D.S. Anderson. So I think having him being a police officer in the first book was crucial for the next following books that are coming up versus being a PI. Just because the next books in the series that I'm writing right now are more forensic related, more dealing with like cyber crimes, dealing with undercover like anarchy groups, things like that. So I think when I planned out this whole series, it was crucial that he be a police officer.
You grew up in a small town in Indiana.
Yes.
And Cedar Lake is in Canada.
Yes.
He's from Saskatchewan.
Yes.
Why did you choose Canada?
So, yeah, the thing with me in Canada, I've always been fascinated with Canada. I have several friends who are Canadians. As a younger teen, young adult, I spent a lot of time in Canada, mainly in the Ontario region, and just loved being there. So when I learned about the U.S. criminal justice system, I have learned it and I understand it. So one of the things when I was writing was I want to learn another country's legal system as well. So to set my books in Canada meant that I had to research everything about how Canadian police procedures work, how their criminal justice, how their courts work. So it was interesting for me as a challenge to learn another country's legal system. And that was the reason why I set my books in another country, to teach myself another country's.
And how significant are the differences?
There are some differences, not many. Mainly it's the Queen's Court, things like that. They have crown prosecutors instead of prosecutors. They usually use constables instead of officers. But mainly, they put you under caution. You don't have Miranda rights, but they have their own charter rights that they read. So there's subtle differences, but it's pretty much the same procedural, just different terms.
We're going to talk about Cedar Lake, which we already mentioned is a town that doesn't sound like a place that I'd really like to hang out. It just didn't seem very pleasant.
No.
Not to put you online from your hometown, how much was it based on your little village in India?
A little bit based on that, especially where I came from. Drugs and crime was very under the surface, but it was brushed aside. People looked the other way for those things. So I kind of used my experience growing up there for this fictional, town with the drugs and the crime and the criminals and how seedy, the seedy underbelly of rural life is. The people think it's picturesque, but they also have their own same problems that you find in larger cities as well. So I wanted to draw that out a little bit, that not every little town is picture perfect that we want to think in our heads that it's that way. It can have some problems, just like Washington, D.C. or New York and places like that.
And that's something I find interesting about small towns is a lot of them have some pretty serious drug problems. I'm currently staying with family up in the California desert, not far from Barstow, which is really kind of out in the middle of nowhere. Yeah. And Barstow used to be the meth capital of the country. And mostly that was because you could have a house in the desert and the police wouldn't smell your meth lab.
They wouldn't be searching, yeah.
Exactly. Based on your experience in the small town, that it is such a problem?
Yeah, I think, I don't know, I want to speculate. I'm not going to say I know for a fact because I don't know for a fact why it's such a problem. But speculating, I would say most people know the police officers. Most people, not every police officer is good. Most are, but some aren't. And I think sometimes you find these buddy-buddy groups where, we're friends, so I'm going to look the other way while you do whatever you need to do. We grew up together. We went to school together. I'm going to look, I'm not going to bust you if you just, do this.
That's a good point. Good point. So back to your story. Let's talk about the plot. What is the story about?
Yeah, so for the first book, No Place is Safe, D.S. Anderson is enjoying his life in Regina. And one morning gets a phone call from his best friend, Gemma, saying that her sister's missing. Her sister has been in rehab, and she disappears from the front steps of the rehab center. And no one has seen her. And so the police think that she's just, gone off on another bender. She got out of rehab. So the police are, hey, we're not going to really follow up. She's been a problem for us for years. So she's probably, she'll show up, things like that. So, but she thinks that it's something really serious. Her sister's never disappeared like that. So she calls D.S. Anderson, begs him to come up. It's a 6-hour drive for him. So he comes up and he, meets with the police officer in charge. And he basically blows him off, and that's how he starts investigating on his own her case. Because even he knows her and knows that, hey, this isn't typical behavior of her. Yeah, she might have a drug problem, but she doesn't just disappear without telling somebody where she is. So, and that's basically part of the series, is trying to find her. But then also, while trying to find her, he's also dealing with his father and dealing with the demons of his past with his father, which he hasn't spoken to his father in several years. And he's also trying to come to terms with the finding out that his mother was having affairs behind behind his father's back, and then trying to figure out what happened to her as well. So there's several subplots going on, and it's basically him coming to terms with trying to deal with his past, but also trying to help his best friend find her sister.
Yeah, I will tell you, early in the novel, when he first gets us to Cedar Lake, it's a pretty short scene. But when he goes there and visits his father, it's very brief. but it's pretty tense.
You
can really feel it.
Yeah, his father's not living the way that he would expect that he would be living.
Yeah, I could feel the somewhat anger and hurt he was going through when he went into his father's house.
Yeah.
So that really came across. So I want to ask about the other important person in the story. I mean, there's quite a few, but really Gemma is the catalyst to all this, and she's been his best friend.
Yeah.
Tell us about her.
Yeah, so Gemma is rambunctious. She's one of those people, we all went to high school, people like that, but she was the one who had a smart mouth. She wasn't focused. She didn't care for authority, and she still doesn't. Into her 30s, she's still carrying that childlike teenager behavior of, I'll do whatever I want, no one's going to tell me what to do. And I think that being friends with D.S. Anderson, for her, he calms her down to the point where she's tolerable, but she also helps him come out of his, you know, rigidness and his just being him, you know, being stubborn. She helps him come out of that. So they're a good pair, I think, together with their personalities.
I will say I really liked her, and it is because the rebel in her.
Yeah.
One thing I really enjoy about being an author is being able to write assholes, which yeah. She wasn't really that, but because I can get out all the crap that I'm feeling through them.
Yeah. Exactly, yeah.
It's a release, and you know, I brought it up before, my protagonist, a lot of people don't like him at all because he is kind of a jerk. And I'm like, he gets to say the things I don't get to say, so, you know, too bad.
Exactly. And that's why we develop those characters. It helps me to deal with, and like, some of these characters are based on people that I know and based on true personalities of people that I grew up with or that I currently know. And I try to blend these different personality traits together to, you know, make these people and make these characters come alive. So, yeah, I think because I used to be very stubborn and still am a little bit, but I also have those friends who are rebels, and they kind of bring me out a little bit and try to make me, you know, meet halfway and compromise. And so it's a yin and yang.
And I generally don't talk about where do you get your ideas or where do your characters come from, because they're really hard questions to answer. But because you brought it up,
yeah,
where did these two come from?
Yeah. So
how much are they based on you or in people in your life?
Yeah, some of the things that happened to D.S. Anderson are based on things that have happened in my actual life. I'm not going to say which scenes or what things happen, but there are certain aspects that are true to my life experience. And one of the Gemma character is based on one of my really good friends that I went to high school with in Indiana, and we're still best friends to this date. And she's that kind of rebel girl, and that's what I love about her. Is, you know, she says whatever she wants and doesn't care what anybody thinks. And I think that helps me be a better person as well.
Well, now you have me so curious that I almost want to go back into the book and find out what Anderson's demons are and try and figure out which ones of them are yours.
Right, yeah, absolutely.
And I actually wouldn't mind reading again at all. You had kind of a strange path getting where you are. You knew at an early age that you did want to be a writer. And then when you went to school, you got your bachelor's in police and your master's in forensics, which I could see as being great studies to be an author, especially for mysteries.
It is, yeah.
But you're currently working as an IT auditor.
So I'm not an IT auditor anymore. No, I'm actually working with the government now also. I was working as an IT auditor before my husband took his first assignment when we moved to Germany in 2017. And then I tried to stay an IT auditor with my company I was with at the time. And I even interviewed in Germany, and I just didn't get the job because of the regulations and things like that they have. So I ended up taking a government job in Germany, and I've been working with the government since. Working in an accounting capacity. So, I went from learning forensics and police studies, and now I'm sitting and working as an accountant, which is good. You can use some of your forensics background in that as well, using, you know, if you're looking for irregularities and things like that, like forensic accounting. So I am able to use some of it to a degree. But I think most of it was just a passion. I love forensics. I grew up watching forensic shows. I grew up watching police procedural shows. And I just loved, you know, that field of study. And I think that wanting to always be a mystery and a suspense and a thriller author, I think getting those two degrees has helped me tremendously with my writing and learning police and how procedures work. And I've been to autopsies and I've seen these things in real life. And so having those real life experiences have helped to develop characters and develop plots and to develop an actual book. So,
well, I could see why watching these on TV would interest you, because we know that forensics on television is very true to life.
It is, yes.
I was being sarcastic.
No, but I mean, my shows that I watch were like Forensic Files and Cold Case Files, things like that, like the old school, not the more like recent like CSI. CSI is, it's so not believable as far as what an actual forensic investigator does. It isn't 20 minutes and you have DNA results. It's days, it's weeks. It's not as quick as they make it seem on TV, which is another whole conversation entirely on how that's tainted the criminal justice and jury system. And, you know, how that's like the main thing. Everybody wants to see DNA. Everybody wants to see evidence and talk to forensics. And that's the main focus. And it's kind of, you know, skewed attitudes and things like that in the U.S.
Yeah, it was interesting that I read that the number of people that want to get into forensics pretty much skyrocketed when the CSI shows came out.
It did.
And the fact that it's not anything like that, I'm sure many were very disappointed. Yeah. And it's understandable why it can't be true to life. I mean, it's a 1-hour show. But you think they would at least carry a story over a few shows to make it somewhat realistic.
Exactly. Right. Yeah.
And I don't know if you've watched any of the CSI shows.
I used to, yes.
I love to make fun of CSI Miami, which was the absolute worst of them all. One of the lead characters is extremely hot. So I did enjoy that aspect. But the rest of the show, I just laughed because it was so bad.
Oh, yeah. And then even CSI Cyber was terrible, too. That was the one that basically lasted one season and then it was canceled.
I never heard of that one.
Oh, yeah, that one. Patricia Arquette was in that and James Vanderbeek were in that. I think Ted Danson made a couple of, you know, appearances in that show as well. But it only lasted one season.
Yeah, I'm shocked because I like Patricia Arquette. So I'm surprised I'd never heard of it. For those that are interested and were fans of CSI, the original, which was in Las Vegas, yep. I just heard they're bringing that back with at least some of the original cast. I don't know how many.
I hadn't heard this yet, so that would be interesting. I actually did enjoy the show. I enjoyed the characters on the show. Not so much the forensic aspect of it, but more the character development. And because I watched it for all 15 seasons when it was on.
Yeah.
And I enjoyed the characters. I enjoyed learning their backstories. Not so much, you know, like I said, not so much their forensic side of that, but the other stuff was interesting enough to keep me watching the show.
Yeah, I talked to many authors on this show about the fact that if you have really good characters, you are given a lot of leeway. Your readers will let you slide on a few things if they like the characters enough.
Exactly, yeah. And I found that to be true with some of my reviews from my books. I found that to be true too. Like, if they like the characters enough, that, you know, they'll make comments about, okay, I don't believe this or that, but the characters made up for, you know, the few mistakes that I found.
Yeah, I've seen that on other reviews. I am going to ask you specifically about one review, which I don't do very often, but we're going to get to that one.
Okay.
Down the road. So I'm going to let you have to wonder what that will be about.
I might think about which one it is, but I think I have an idea, but.
Back to the question, though, you were working in IT and now you're working with the government. But still, how did it go from studying law enforcement to getting in IT and your current job?
Yeah, so the thing for me was that when I did my master's in cyber forensics, I applied to many positions. People wanted experience. They didn't really seem to care that you have a degree and that you spent, you know, 2 years getting educated and learning how to do things. So I found a guy who wanted to work for a company. I'm not going to say the company name, but it's a big worldwide company. They do a lot of auditing. And I found myself working with the public sector for them, which was basically government contracts and doing IT auditing for them, auditing IT systems for the government. specifically with Medicare and Medicaid when they rolled out the Affordable Care Act. Was working on a lot of those projects with that. I found it to be interesting because it was sort of like using the forensics that I learned. We were looking for like weaknesses and vulnerabilities and things like that in their system and calling them out for that and then having them making sure that that gets fixed. So I found that I was using somewhat to a degree. The law enforcement side is so saturated with people in forensics. Like we were talking about earlier, like they skyrocketed people trying to get degrees in forensics. And so there's just no jobs out there, not anywhere that I was living. I was living in Baltimore at the time, and Baltimore was saturated. That whole area was saturated. They didn't need anybody to work in forensics. So, and I was too old to be working as a police officer
yeah.
by this point. If you're going to be a police officer, you need to start that when you're in your 20, 21, and not in your mid-30s, pushing 40. That's too late in the game, I think.
Well, I know nothing about Baltimore today. I do remember loving the crab cakes there. But when I lived back east, which was many moons ago, it was always known as a pretty dangerous city to live in. So I would think they'd have lots of people that work in forensics.
Yeah, so they used to, and then budget cuts. So I have several friends who work for the Baltimore City Police. And so I had the inter hearings about what was happening. They just weren't looking for forensic people anymore. And it still is pretty dangerous there. But, you know, I digress. I tried and I found that I enjoy working for the government more than using and working in forensics. So
I mentioned earlier that I'm sure your schooling helped you with these novels. I can imagine they did. Are there any specific things that you learned that you can recall that were really important that you were able to use when writing?
So in some of my earlier novels, I took a class, and when I was working on my bachelor's, I took a death investigation class, and I also took a forensic photography class. And both of those classes, I was able to visit the medical examiner's office and basically stand in and witness autopsies, like standing right next to them while they were doing them and taking photos. And I think that was able to learn and ask them questions about, like, what are you doing with this? What is that? It helped me with writing some of my earlier novels when there were some scenes where they were in you know, the medical examiner, and I was able to use some of my, you know, stuff I learned to bring that forward for my readers. That was the one thing I found very interesting about that was that, you know, I still have the photos and things like that, and it was an interesting experience.
I can imagine. You worked in some pretty heavy-hitting jobs. I know IT, my husband's IT, and I don't know if you're like him, but he works extremely long hours, crazy work.
I did, yeah.
And I'm sure it's probably similar work with the government. So how are you able to balance? You put out two books just a year apart from each other. I didn't look at your earlier books to see how long. That's a pretty good pace for somebody that's working a full-time job. How are you able to balance that?
Yeah, so I have a very understanding husband who encourages me to at least, you know, dedicate 2 hours a day to writing. Even if I've just done an 8-hour shift at work or 10 hours, he'd be like, if you want to write, go ahead and write. You know, he doesn't stand in my way. He encourages me to do as much as I can. But I also take breaks. You got to just, for me, I go with the flow. If I need to write, I will just sit and write. I can write like 2,000 to 3,000 word names in one sitting. And sometimes I take a couple of days off. I don't have anything. That nothing's coming to me, or I need time to think about what are the next moves for these characters. So I'll take a couple of days off. So it's just, it balances. Sometimes I'll hit it really hard, and then some days I'll be really lazy and just take some time and spend with my husband to make up for those days that he doesn't, you know, get any of my time.
That's very sweet. He sounds like a keeper.
Oh, definitely. 13 years. So yeah, he's definitely a keeper.
13 years. It sounds like it might work out.
I think so, yeah.
That's about how long my husband and I have been together. Tell him I don't know the exact year, but
won't say anything.
Right. It's been right about that. So I want to talk about one of your other series, or actually the only other series that you had. But first I want to get to the review that I said I just can't pass up.
Okay.
And because it made me bristle, and I had one that was similar to it. It was a review of No Place is Safe.
Yep.
And by, I'm going to use the term loosely, a gentleman named Dr. David Brown. And I'm saying his name on the air because it's right there on Amazon for all to see. And what he wrote made me laugh, but I was disturbed too. And so for our listeners, I'm going to read what he said. An intriguing storyline that is ruined by making the tragic hero and his colleague gay lovers. Totally unnecessary to what could have been a pretty good book. I want to pretend that Dr. Brown is listening right now. What do you have to say to him?
Yeah, if you didn't like gay characters, then why would you pick up a book that's clearly listed in the LGBT thriller mystery genre on Amazon? I don't understand why you would pick the book up if you didn't want to read about two gay characters, which there are gay people in the world. So honestly, there's going to be gay characters in books. It was unnecessary. It wasn't even necessary to even write the review. And that goes for anybody. If you don't like gay characters, don't read the book. It's pretty spelled out pretty clearly that there is gay characters in the book. I do have it listed. I know on Amazon it's listed under the LGBT category. And all the categories are LGBT. There's no like just basic category for it. So I'm just miffed by why someone would write something very hurtful like that.
Yeah. Well, I think a lot of people don't look to see the category. They just see a mystery and they read it and they think, oh, this sounds like a good mystery. And
yeah.
So I can see how somebody could stumble on it. I guess the reason I brought it up is the fact that he says it's a good book, yet has to knock it for that reason. And that it makes me sad.
Yeah.
It makes me sad. So
it makes me very sad too.
I think for my own purpose, I had to bring it up because I just don't get it.
I don't get it. I did see that somebody did come to my defense, though. Someone did reply to his comment. So that did make me restore my faith in humanity, that someone did come to my defense to say, hey.
That's good that they kept it up. I did a response to Wishful Drinking is a book by Carrie Fisher. And somebody made some – I adore her. And somebody made some comments about her name dropping all the time. And I'm like, she grew up in the middle of Hollywood with stars. She's not name driving. That's her life, you know?
That's her life.
And so
right, yeah.
I responded back, and I must have been too harsh because Amazon took it down.
Wow.
I'm glad it's still there in Goodreads. I got what I wanted to say out there, but Amazon must have said, you know, that's a little too nasty. We're going to bring your book down.
We're going to take that down. Yeah, I'm wondering if I don't know if Amazon's ever took anything down that maybe other people have responded to that comment and they took it down. I'm not 100% sure. I just know that I recently did look at it again within like the last 2 months, and I did see that someone had replied, so I was happy.
I try not to read my reviews. I try to have people review them for me because I just find it's healthier that way, though sometimes I can't help myself.
Yeah.
And yet, I've had books taken down, and I know other authors have books taken down for no reason whatsoever. And the presumption, I guess, on Amazon's side is you must have known the person. Maybe they sing your praises too high or whatever. That tends to be the most common reason why they take books down. And a lot of people assume, oh, they must search Amazon for friendships, which would be really bad because a lot of my readers friended me on Facebook. So, I am interacting with them and they have gotten to know me at least virtually. And so maybe they did get a little too excited when they wrote the review. But, just leave it there.
I completely agree.
Yeah, and my husband said if I liked your damn book, I should be able to say I liked your book.
You should be able to say it, exactly. I'm like, so my family my family used to, on some of my earlier novels, they would comment and leave reviews because they're avid readers and they enjoyed the book. So they're not saying something they wouldn't normally say. So, yeah, but they don't do that anymore. I've told them not to, please don't review my books anymore. I can get in trouble for that, so.
Yeah, exactly. See, I'm lucky in podcasts. I can have anybody do a review, and it's not scrutinized the way it is with books. So, and I actually haven't. I haven't taken advantage of it, but I could easily call my friends and family and say, hey, can you do some reviews? And now I'm thinking about it, maybe I should.
You totally could, yeah.
Yeah, maybe I should. I can take advantage of it. It would make me feel wrong for about a minute and a half. Okay, so I said I was going to bring up your other series, and that is the Alex Jones series.
Yeah.
And I want to bring it up because I was very intrigued by something. You wrote two novels, and Alex was a teen in book one.
He was, yes.
A year later, you wrote book two, and 7 years has passed, and Alex is actually a homicide detective.
Right, with the NYPD, yeah.
Which I found an interesting jump. So I'm curious, what made you decide to do that? And I had in my head, why didn't he just continue to jump every 7 years? So why didn't you continue? First, why did you make the jump? And then why didn't you continue the series?
So sure. To answer the first part of that, Alex Jones series, the first book, An Unsettled Past, I wrote when I was 18. And that was the book that I didn't publish until I was 36. So when I started writing the book was set in like the late 90s. And so I wanted to keep the book set in the late 90s because that was the mind frame I was in back then. And that was where the story was. That's where the story began. And so the 7 year jump was when in 2007, I had started writing that second book in 2007. So there was a time jump, and I wanted to show that the character had developed and grown up, and it wasn't so teen boppy as the first book was. I wanted it to be more of a mature novel, more geared towards adults. The first book is more geared towards like young adult, teen. And the second book, I wanted to kind of get out of that genre and more focus on doing the more adult fiction.
I will tell you, I found that confusing. I happened to read a review and somebody referred to it as a young adult novel. And I looked at and I thought, I didn't know he was a young adult author. What I saw wasn't young adult. And actually, you don't even have it listed under young adult.
Yeah. And to answer the second part of your question, I'm not actually done writing that series. I've just taken a break from Alex Jones. I had some other characters in my head that had been stirring and I wanted to write. And so I did do a one-off novel in between. I thought, okay, I'll just write a one-off novel, which was Among the Ashes. And so I wrote that one in between. And then the whole D.S. Anderson idea came into my head, and this character got, you know, I started writing about this character and developing this character and all the other characters that went with the book. And so I wanted to explore some other character lines, but I haven't given up on Alex Jones, and we are going to revisit him again in the future, probably within the next couple of years. It's going to be a trilogy, ultimately. There will be one more novel in that series. And that is just to wrap everything up, because a lot has happened in those books as well. So I don't want to leave the readers hanging who have enjoyed those novels, but it's also not on the front burner right now. I need a break from that character. That character is pretty intense as well. And the second book in that series got really intense at the end. So I needed a break to think about where is this going to finish and how is this going to finish. I want to give him a good send-off.
Many authors wait years and years before they get back to their characters. So,
yeah,
that's okay. That's A-okay. But I am curious, of the five novels that you wrote, it's the middle one, number three, that is the standalone. How was that experience different than writing the series novels?
So that one, I thought about making a series, but then I decided that the character, he wasn't as interesting to me as I anticipated he would be. And it was just something for me to try different. I also wrote that book in second person. It's not written in first person. It's not written in third person. It's a second person novel. And that was something for me to test. I wanted to test that with my audience, and people did not like that. People say they prefer third person or first person. Most people prefer third person. So that was part of another reason why I kind of scrapped the idea of that being a series.
Yeah, second person, I don't want to say it's fallen out of favor, but you don't see it very often anymore like it used to be.
You don't. And that was something I was like, oh, I don't see this. I want to try to be different. I want to differentiate myself as an author from other authors. And it just didn't go over well. And it has nothing to do with me as an author. It just, you know, people just don't like that style. So,
Well, it sounds interesting to me. I may pick it up.
Yeah. Definitely look into it.
So you are an Indiana boy who is now in Australia.
I am, yeah.
And now I know you haven't been there that long, but I'm still going to toss this question out there. When you're writing, is your brain thinking, okay, I have to write for an Australian audience as well as American audience? And the reason I'm bringing this up is Garrick Jones is an author who lives in Australia. Excellent writer. He also happens to be a friend of mine. And we were chatting online one day, and I don't know why, but in the conversation, I mentioned a toaster oven. And we continued the conversation, and he stopped me and he said, while we were talking, I looked up a toaster oven. I have never seen anything like that before. Don't you have those hot things underneath the stove?
Right, right.
I was shocked that he would have no idea what a toaster oven is. Do you keep that in mind in any sense?
I try not to use words that are different in different countries, and especially in the English speaking countries. I will never put, like, we call things grilled cheese. They call them toasties here. I would probably just never write the word grilled cheese in any of my books, just to not confuse people with different words. Most Australians, I understand, you know, they know what a bathroom is. They might call it something else, like in the UK they would call it a loo, but they know what mm-hmm. a bathroom is. So I think that there's certain words, I just wouldn't use a lot of the slangy words that they... I keep that kind of stuff in mind when I'm, you know, writing.
Well, you could just call it a cheese-filled toast sandwich.
Yeah, yeah. You could be generic about it, yeah.
That sounds natural. I could hear anybody saying that.
And the other thing, too, is like I had a lot of friends in Germany who would read my books, and there were words that they didn't understand, but they would actually look them up. Mm-hmm. So they would take the time and go and Google, like if they didn't understand it, they would highlight it and they would go to Google and figure out what it was. Like they don't call things like two-story, like we say two-story homes. Mm-hmm. They don't say two-story, they call them multi-level. So it's little differences. So they had to look up what certain things meant. But I think a lot of people, I think there's a feature actually in Kindle now that you can actually highlight a word if you don't understand it and it will give you the definition for it, I believe.
Yes, actually, there is. There is that.
So I think that is a really helpful thing for people.
I have a lot of friends that when they read, they will, especially if it's a novel written somewhere outside the United States, that they will research what that means, just like you just mentioned.
Yeah.
I'm lazy. I either read it again to see if I can figure out what they're talking about, and if I don't, I just move on.
Yeah, exactly. Yep.
Well, surprisingly, we are coming to the end of the show, and I have to tell you that we have something that's called Awkward Questions Authors Get. And what I do is I spin the wheel, and I have a selection of questions. These are questions that I surveyed dozens of authors and said, what have you been asked that are weird or just you get that are difficult to answer? And so I have a list, and I'm going to spin the wheel, and you're going to get one of those.
Okay.
So hold on, and I'm going to spin the wheel here. I have one for you. Why is your protagonist so dumb?
I actually don't think that my protagonist is dumb. I think my protagonist is a pretty smart guy. He sometimes is misguided. But I would definitely not say he's dumb. I think that he's a pretty smart guy. He has to be smart in order to catch criminals and find missing people and deal with forensic evidence. You can't be dumb and be dealing with those things, I don't think.
So he's not one of those that just stumbles on solving the crime?
No. He put some work into it, some investigating, some hunches, following his instincts. And I think that...
I'm very glad that you support him, and because I think that is a very rude question that somebody would ask an author.
Yeah, definitely, yeah.
Unless it's a book that has a lot of humor and he's supposed to be dumb.
That could be, yeah.
That would be a whole different story.
Exactly.
So once again, my guest today has been C.L. Breeze, and I want to thank you very much for being on today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
and we discussed his D.S. Anderson thriller series. The first novel is No Safe Place, and the second novel is Trail of Deception. And I need to ask you, must they be read in order?
They are two totally separate storylines, but I will say if you read the first book, No Place is Safe, you will have a better understanding as to book two, Trail of Deception, because there is one paragraph in the first book that talks about the whole story plot of the second book. And I would be interested to see if people, when they read the first book and then read the second book, if they can figure out where that one paragraph was where what happened in book two is discussed.
I'm a big proponent of, in a series, each book being able to read as a standalone. It's always a lot more fun to start with book one. But yes, I like the idea of somebody just reaches on the shelf. Maybe they're in the library and they don't have the whole series, that they can reach the shelf and read a book. So good on you.
Yep, exactly. Thank you.
Okay, Chris. Well, thank you again for being on. It's been a pleasure.
Hey, Brad, thanks for having me. Yeah, it's been a pleasure talking to you as well.